I don't know what I want to do first. I'm just going to...
Choose the most Keith pick. What's the most Keithy pick?
Whatever that means. You,
that, Keith. Like, fucked me up way more than it should have.
Who am I?
I don't know!
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From San Diego, California, Keith Foster.
Hi, I realized the last episode that I forgot to introduce you. So
yes, you did.
I'm not going to do that this week. I'm going to introduce the host of the show, Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
Oh, I thought by saying you're not going to, you were like refusing from now on to ever introduce me.
Oh, I should.
I mean, I'm just going to go back and like edit that part in from another episode. I've done that before, but I was too lazy. So there's a whole episode where nobody knows my name. But we do know our guest this week because he used to be the co-host of this program. He's coming in.
That's right.
Jabber alum, Richard Wally.
My jersey up on the window? No, that's not how they do it. They do it on the wall. There we go. Yeah, I'm here. How's it going?
Good. Yeah, so, you know, every October, I think we've had you back to do a Halloween-related episode. Cause this is your month. This is your...
I'm pretty sure people only think I'm alive in October. Lots more people reach out and I see people a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
So just a reminder to everybody, I am a human the other 11 months of the year,
it's
not
the
just
season
October.
Of the witch. It's the
you
season of,
dog.
It's the season of the dick.
This is going terribly already, but, this episode we're going to be finishing off our horror draft, our decade draft that we've been doing for the last few episodes. So this week we're going to be doing a list of 15 instead of 10 since we have an extra guest. We're going to be talking about the 15 best movies of the early 2000s, 2000 through 2010. And at the end of the program, we are going to review the new Halloween reboot sequel, whatever you want to call it.
It's a requel.
The requel, Halloween 2018. We are not going to be talking about the movie Teeth. We'll have to wait until next week. But I figure it kind of makes sense. The first week of October, we accidentally did a review of The Star Is Born. The 1970s,
yeah, okay.
A Star Is Born. So now there is going to be a Halloween review in the first week of November.
I just want to point out that I was like stressing to see Teeth because I hadn't seen it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took a calculated risk. I looked at what Teeth was rated R for.
Yeah.
And it said, you know, like sexual situations and drug use and stuff. And I was like, okay, I can probably get away with watching this at work.
Oh.
Yeah, that's not
I
smart.
Mean, we'll talk about it more next week, but
yeah,
strap in for that. Stay tuned
to hear the rest of that story.
Yeah.
About the story about how Keith got fired and is now has to go door to door and announce himself as a sexual predator. So Richard, let's catch up with you a little bit. You're in the middle of a move.
Several, yeah.
Things are afoot.
I don't know. I feel like, I mean, yeah, you have a kid now, but I feel like you're happiest on the road.
I mean, we have been over about 70% of the United States in the last few months.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. So we moved from Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 days after we moved from Portland, we drove from the Idaho wilderness of my in-law's house to Michigan. And then from Michigan, we drove to Orlando. And then from Orlando, we flew to Salt Lake City. I stayed in Salt Lake City while Jackie flew to Portland. And then we've basically been living through three households for a while. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, and we made a pit stop in Vegas for like 4 or 5 days. So, you know, good times.
Yeah.
Good times.
Yeah. Do we know where we live yet?
No. We've pared it down to 4 options. Three now. Sorry. Excuse me. 3 options. We might end up in Salt Lake. We might end up in, Vegas, or we might end up in mystery area number 3 that I can't discuss. We refer to it as Borneo. So.
Oh, right. Jesus Christ. Okay. Well, my money's still on Vegas because then I could visit you guys.
Yeah, it would be a nice central location for everyone to kind of congregate. And, you should try and do it before, Thanksgiving, because I'm going to go up there and have Thanksgiving with the friends. So let's regress again and talk about horror films. I'm going to let Richard, start the draft, get the first pick, since he hasn't been on. And then I'll let, Keith go, and then I'll go third, and we'll go like that till we get to number 15. I guess we've been starting this off a little bit, just sort of talking about the decades in which we're, you know, talking about per week. And I don't know, the 2000s is an interesting time. I think, you know, we talked about how the 90s was in some circles kind of considered sort of a dark age for horror, because a lot of what was coming out was either terrible sequels or like more adult-themed thrillers rather than horror proper. And I think we see the rebirth of an interest in horror in the 2000s with the rise of like J-horror and later like the gore films or whatever. But I think also, I think that's how I would characterize the early 2000s, is this sort of re-embrace of schlock. Like, and
there's lots of peaks and valleys there too.
Yeah, I don't necessarily mean schlock in a derogatory sense. I meant like a sort of embrace of genre for its own sake.
I feel like the early 2000s, in a lot of ways is sort of a return to horror roots, because the 90s were so obsessed with like teen slashers specifically and
irony. And meta stuff. And,
yeah, either yeah. that or Silence of the Lambs, like, retreads. And I feel like the 2000s, you get, it sort of is like a redub of the 70s, I think, in a lot of ways.
I wouldn't go that far. I think there's less of a tour vision going on in the 2000s. than there is in the 70s. But what I do think we see is, and this affects all cinema, not just horror, but the rise of special effects in the early 2000s and
true.
CGI has a big impact on the types of movies that get made and how they're made. And I think that there's kind of like this 80s fanboy geek thing. You know, maybe sort of like the Tarantino generation or the Kevin Smith generation, like coming of age in the early 2000s and making the type of films they've always wanted to see or that they grew up on.
Well, I think the 90s too, like going back to the meta and all that, I think it had to happen because I think it was a last gasp because, I mean, the 80s were chock full of slashers as well.
Yeah.
It was just kind of the era of the slashers.
The unironic slasher.
And I mean, post-2010, I'm sorry if I'm spoiling next episode or something, but I mean, you also have the ghosts, you also have, you've had a zombie cycle, we've had a lot of different cycles even within the 2000s.
For sure.
So, and I mean, in the 2000s, the zombie cycle really is when it, like, re-inflamed.
Really resurges.
So, yeah. And I'm sure some of those movies will come up. So, Richard, why don't you start us out? What is your first pick for, and this doesn't have to be in any particular order, but, you know.
I'm going to go for my first pick. I'm going to go a little, like, pseudo-personal.
Okay.
This movie I was actually introduced to by my uncle, who is a pretty big part of my life. And he's kind of what started me looking at films, like, different films outside of, like, the basics. Now, this is a horror film, but I think he chose this one specifically for that reason. And that film is the 2000 film American Psycho. We follow a nice young man named Patrick Bateman in his world of business as he slaughters and kills hookers in his pastime. And, it's the weirdest movie because it's played so flat. Mm. And I don't mean flatten as in the acting, but I mean it's like just deadpan.
Yeah.
But it is
very glib.
In the right crowd, it is humorous. And, but in another crowd, it's like disturbing. So,
I think it's both. I think it's fair
it rides
to say.
A line. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And but that's something to like about it. I also like the ambiguousness of it. I know some people say none of it happens. I don't choose to see it that way. To me, the ambiguousness there's kind of an exaggeration of saying how much some yuppie at this time period could get away with.
Yeah, I recently heard that interpretation of the movie where it's like, no, all of this is real. He just gets away with it because of like who he is and his position in life.
Status. And
yeah, I like that reading so much more. I think,
well, I think it's his serial killer slaughter cocaine mix.
Yeah.
I think he's just doing so much cocaine that that's what his life feels like.
Yeah.
So that's another part of it for me. But yeah, that's the interpretation that I specifically have always used.
Yeah. I think certainly the movie is maybe more thematically concerned than narratively. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I think that's one of its strengths is that it's, you know, definitely a class critique. It's definitely a satire of the 80s Reagan, period and yuppie culture. And yeah, I mean, it's on my list for sure.
Oh yeah, I was going straight for you, Cassidy.
You went straight for the throat.
I was going straight for the stomach with that one. Yeah. No, I again, the acting is also superb. Like, it feels realistic at times.
A younger
also,
Christian Bale, yeah.
I mean, that axe scene is just one of the best. It's just a great scene in cinema.
Very quotable, very culty. I love the visual design of the movie. It's really like minimal and stark and steely and metallic. Yeah, Mary Harron.
I don't go for it usually, but it works in this one too well. But
yeah, it kind of plays off the sort of distance and the coldness of the character while at the same time still being really funny. And I think yeah. Intentionally so. I love the movie a lot. Keith, what is your first pick?
All right. I can see that we're going to spend about 25 minutes talking about each one of these.
We don't have to.
Oh,
we don't
Jesus.
Have to.
We mentioned zombies earlier and people listen to the podcast know that I'm a fan of the comedy. So I'm going to pick one of my favorites of the zombie resurgence, and that is, Edgar Wright's Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah.
This movie, for me, came out at like the perfect time. It was like right as the zombie thing was kind of coming back, and it's not, the thing I like about this movie is it's not a parody, but it is like a love letter, to zombie mm-hmm. movies. It makes fun, like you have fun in the zombie universe without it being, without losing all the stakes and having nothing matter. It's...
Well, and pointing out the obvious.
Yeah.
Like pointing out specifically that like, oh, sometimes they're schlocky. Oh, good job.
Yeah, and it's yeah. genuinely funny and charming and also, it has some of the most brutal, horrifying zombie violence in zombie films. So, Shaun of the Dead, one of my favorite zombie movies of all time. And it's fun, and it introduced the world to Edgar Wright. Plus, the name pun alone for the title is pretty great.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to think about, like, this movie kind of comes out in the middle of the bad parody movie. Like, this is when there's like Epic Movie and
yeah
300 Spartans and all of that bullshit, that like post Scary Movie stuff.
Well, I don't think this movie isn't
no I know, but what I think that what separates this from those is what you've already mentioned. It actually cares about stakes and actually cares about, creating, like, you know, paying off the genre stuff in a way that the others don't. They're just flatly referencing and calling it a comedy. This actually has characters too. And it's a character driven movie, like all Edgar Wright stuff is.
For sure. And, you know, cause when I think of parody, I think of like Mel Brooks, which I love, old Mel Brooks movies, but those are straight up comedy parodies. Like their primary function is to tell the joke. This isn't that. This is a zombie movie first that just happens to be a little more lighthearted and a little more funny than the average zombie movie, which I think makes you care about the characters more than the average zombie movie because they feel like people you would hang out with.
Well, it's a zombie movie that takes place in a world that knows what a zombie movie is. And that's the difference between it and, say, like, the Romero movies.
Cool.
I also would like to say that when I said a Keith movie, I literally underlined Shaun of the Dead. So my subtle, just little pick at your brain at work. Yeah. Just so you know.
It did because that was not going to be my first pick. I changed it at the last second. All right, Cassidy.
Okay.
What's your pick?
My first pick, I'm going to go the other direction on zombie movies, and it's another pivotal movie for the resurgence of the genre, and that is Danny Boyle's 28 Days Later, which on certain days might be my favorite Danny Boyle film as well. This, in a lot of ways, is really indicative of early 2000s, because not only is it the embrace of genre again as done through, you know, kind of a different lens or a different sort of mindset, but it is also one of the first films, like mainstream films, that was to come out that was shot on DV, on video, instead of on film. And Danny Boyle kind of like leans into the grainy sort of, you know, video now you can make it look like fucking, you know, everyone's using digital and it looks, you know, fairly indistinguishable from film or in some cases even more consistent and better. But, back then that was not the case. It was very much kind of a low grade thing. The only people I think who were really kind of messing around with video was like, the Danish Dogma films and like super, super low budget, micro budget filmmaking. And here he like takes on a big kind of special effects-y, bloody gory horror film with this, grainy sort of film style. And beyond that, I think it's just a really effective, brooding, scary film that's really unnerving. He's really good at building tension, throughout. And, to this day, it is still a horror film that is, you know, sending ripples through the style of not only zombie films, but a lot of what we're seeing, you know, later in like the found footage and blah, blah, blah.
This was also, one of the first movies to introduce the idea of like the really fast, like aggressive zombie.
The kind of rabid zombies.
Yeah, prior to this, they were sort of a lurking, shambling, like...
corpse.
Sort of like a, I can't think of the word, but entropy threat. Like, eventually, they're just gonna wear you down and get you and you're gonna die. Whereas this is like, oh no, they're like an active predator. And so it sort of revitalized the genre in that sense too, because it was like, all of a sudden, zombies were scary again. You know, compare them to the ones in Shaun of the Dead where they're literally making fun of how slow and shambling they are. And this is like, well, what if they weren't? What if, they were fucking rage psychos that a single drop of their blood will turn you into one?
And this film has a really strange kind of pacing. It's kind of slow and meandering at times and then really fast, like you said, at times. And I think that one of the integral parts of this film that's, that comes around and while it is new and it touches on a lot of those touchstones, one of the things it also does though is it touches on older themes. And that older theme is that the zombies aren't actually the monster by the end of the film. Mm-hmm. There's a much more human threat.
Yeah.
And, That's one of my favorite parts of this film.
Yeah.
Yeah, same thing. That idea that, humanity is still the ultimate threat.
All right. Richard.
My fourth film is a film that I didn't watch when it initially came out. I saw it a little bit later, but not too much later after its release. It was definitely on home video. It's the film Slither by James Gunn. Now, this is his first directorial debut, and it's a horror, but it's very hard horror comedy. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't, it gives you the, it's, it, what's interesting about it is while it's horror, it's a body horror comedy that had, I, when I rewatched it, I was like, man, this has some actually really cool themes. And just as basically afraid of, you know, the breeding ground of the rural areas. The jokes are funny. The body horror makes you squirm. The acting's fun. And you get to start to see some of the hallmarks of a director I really like. And these are the things that kind of go into later. You see him in Guardians of the Galaxy and stuff like that. But, it's kind of a basic, almost like 50s horror kind of like alien setup. Something crashes and then it gets in, but then it gets very almost like Alien to, you know, turned up to 11, but funny. And, watching some of that again, like there's the barn scene that one just sticks in your brain, you know?
Yeah.
It doesn't go away.
It's a fucking gross movie. I mean, it is funny and it's fun and I love this movie, but I also kind of love how gross it is because it has that sort of like Cronenberg-y body horror aspect to it, which
mixed with a little bit, I would say obviously a little bit of trauma. Flair.
For sure. For sure. juvenile, gross out comedy mixed in with extreme body horror and I guess like an exploitation edge, but here with an actual film budget, even though, you know, relatively speaking, this would still be considered a low budget film. It's like fucking, Heaven's Gate compared to a trauma film.
No, that's not untrue. But talking about that, even though that those, the thing is I would say that blending it like he did, that's not an easy thing to do. And then actually showing it on screen and making it work, because it could easily just be laughable and pass, you know, just be able to pass it off.
Yeah.
But this is a film that's stuck with me. I love watching it. The characters are fun. I mean, it almost kind of, I would say you could watch this with Shaun of the Dead and it be kind of in a similar.
Oh, for sure. Game. This is kind of what I was talking about, you know, with the fanboy horror geek coming into the realm of being able to make those movies now.
That's true. You know? Actually, looking at my list, I'm seeing a few of those, so.
Yeah. I mean, even Danny Boyle's, 28 Days Later there's a little bit of that going on. He's trying to elevate it a little bit, and I think he might be a little bit more embarrassed of his fanboyness. But
well, I don't think so. I think the fanboyness primarily comes from Alex Garland
in that arena.
that's another big one. That's, you know, he's a bigger director at this time period, and it really it shows where he came from and why. Mm-hmm. He's an amazing writer and now director. So
yeah, for sure. All right, cool. I'm into that.
All right, I'm gonna change tones a little bit, get away from the horror comedy and the zombie style thing, and go for a movie that just sort of gutted me the first time I saw it. One of my personal favorite horror movies, and I think one of the ones with one of the biggest bummer endings you'll ever see. I'm talking about Frank Darabont's version of Stephen King's novel, The Mist.
Novella.
I have that on my list too.
Yeah, I think this is one of the best Stephen King adaptations out there still. And he's getting some new play. I love this movie. I also think it's one of the best, it's got a sort of like subtle cosmic terror that I really enjoy. I think the monsters are real scary. my biggest complaint about this movie is when you go back and watch it now, the CGI is a little dated for some of the scenes. But the story itself, I love, and also plays into the themes of, you know, who's the real monster, the monsters outside, or the monsters you're stuck with that wear human skin and call themselves humans.
Apocalyptic, societal horror.
Yeah, this movie fires all my engines as far as that goes. And, yeah, I don't know. And just some of the visualization too. You know, like a movie called The Mist, you know, how is mist supposed to be threatening? You know, but it's atmospheric as hell. I think Thomas Jane gives a fantastic performance, as well as, what's her name? Lady Carmody?
Marcia Gay Harden, I think that's her name, the actress.
Yeah, really gets to ham it up as a
She's doing the Stephen King, cliched, overly religious zealot character.
For sure, for sure. But she plays
but doing
the mother
it very
from
well.
Carrie.
But doing it very well.
Well, and I want just to riff on a little something. This, I think, is in a similar vein to what you're talking about in the fact that, you know, these horror fans, cause Frank Darabont specifically went into this film making another, like, kind of, he wanted the monsters to feel like they're out of a, you know, a 50s horror movie.
Yeah.
And I would say,
it's referencing,
you know, the CG in
movies.
Color doesn't hold up, but I have a version of the film where you can watch it in black and white. And I actually think the monsters look even better. And I only watch that movie in black and white, which may find it's pretentious, but I think it's really fun that way. It really feels like a throwback, but like with modern sensibilities.
Well, it was originally shot to be in black and white, and the studio wouldn't let him.
Fuck
sounds
studios.
About right.
Studios ruin all the good horror movies.
But yeah, I mean, that's a fine film. It's a little controversial of a pick. I have talked to some people who really don't like it, and that ending rubs them the wrong way, but I like bummer endings, and that's, you know, that's why Seven was on my list last week. Cool. I'm gonna go in another direction too. And, Keith, I hope you're sitting down for this one. I'm gonna go with, the American remake, cause it's the only version of it I saw. Michael Haneke's Funny Games.
Fuck you. Ugh, this movie's trash. I fucking hate this movie.
Half the reason I picked it is for that response.
We're never gonna be done with this fucking movie.
The other half of the reason I picked it is because I think it's effective. And it had been a while since I'd seen it, since we did it together on the podcast as Netflix homework. And it, bothered me a lot more. I think I'm of an age now where I, maybe have more empathy or that I have a little bit more sort of like a realistic perspective of the, you know, I wasn't just watching it as a genre film. I actually kind of got into it that time as like a human piece. Even though the movie is very much, very, very self-referential about talking about genre in a big way. It is very meta in the same way. I mean, it was in the same way that a movie like Scream is, because the original was made in the 90s and then he remade it in 2007. But I think it's a really hyper-focused, incisive, take on the home invasion thriller. I think that it is mean and nasty and unapologetic. And I do think it's saying some interesting things about why people watch violent films or why they think they like them, and sort of playing around with the audience expectations and that kind of stuff. It's not a comfortable watch. It's not a fun movie in some ways. But I do think it's really well made. There's other Haneke films, you know, that kind of are in this ballpark. Something like Caché is also a really fine film, maybe even a better film. But I think that's a little bit more on the thriller aspect of things. I think this one is his most liked explicit horror film.
It's the most overt one for sure.
Yeah.
I always liked the film. It is dark. I wouldn't watch it a lot. Mm-hmm. Mostly because as a horror watcher, it questions me. You know,
it's
it questions whether,
you.
It does a little bit, but I don't think.
Oh, I think it does more than a little bit.
And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing because, you know, I always forget this term, but I always remember basically from one of we were in a monsters, class in college. Mm. It was about the folklore of monsters. And she always brought up, and our teacher in this class always brought up this idea of while fantasy mirrors reality, it's also scary to think that it goes the reverse way. And sometimes we do have to think about that. We're sometimes feeding people's fantasies through what we watch just because it doesn't do it to us. Mm-hmm. It might do it to someone else. So I think that this is, while I can live with that, this is definitely a very blatant, like, no, this is what you came here for.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Watch this. So. I feel chastised, but in a good way.
I think this movie is wet, hot garbage. I hated it. I don't like it.
And that's usually the range of opinions on this movie. You're going to be on the me and Richard camp on it, or you're going to be on the Keith camp. I've rarely met somebody who was like, yeah, it's all right.
Here's the thing. I hear all of the things you're saying. And I like all of the things you're saying. I just didn't think the movie, to me, did it in any effective or interesting ways. To me, it feels like it does it in,
So you think it's ugly shot and like the technical aspects of it aren't well done?
No, but I'm not going to say like it's shot fine. It's purely story stuff I have problems with. I don't like this movie.
I think the themes bother you, but that's okay.
Well, to me, this movie is so stuck up its own ass that it's just like, it feels like the movie's talking down to me. And I just am like, I get what you're doing. I just don't like it.
Fair enough. I mean, a lot of people have had very similar responses. Famously, I think both versions were booed at Cannes. But famously, everything is booed at Cannes. Go ahead, Richard. What's your next pick?
Well, then I'm going to throw this in here because Guillermo del Toro's films just go about looking at the genre differently. And I think people have a hard time getting out of the roller coaster ride of films or, you know, the satire or whatever. His films are more human, are more humanistic, and are trying to look at how we relate to the violent, how we relate to the creepy.
You have to pick one.
I am. That one is The Devil's Backbone.
Okay. Yeah.
Cool.
Obviously all his films are great, the reason I picked The Devil's Backbone is, it's just the one that, I don't know, I guess I relate to it. Just because they're, you know, all these young kids confined at the school and like just kind of being in a desolate area and stuff like that. So I don't know. I just connect to it on a level. I haven't really maybe thought that out completely, but I know that just the atmosphere of it. And, you know, this is another film that touches on older theme that man is the monster.
Uh-huh.
The ghosts in it, while they are, I think this is one of the most, effective uses of ghosts. Just all the quirks and, the history and just the details that Guillermo always puts in his films. But yeah, no, The Devil's Backbone, I think is, there's something about this one that, just how the building is set up where some of the, you know, where the big bomb is dropped in the middle of the lot, how that all interacts with the story and what that tells you as you're watching, because you have a lot to unpack.
Yeah. I like this movie a lot. Me and Keith, kind of talked about it in detail in our, Guillermo del Toro rundown when, Shape of the Water came out. And I said that, you know, I think this is probably his darkest film. Both, you know, actual literally darkest in lighting, but also, thematically. It's great. You know, there's a few other Spanish adjacent horror films that came out in this era too. So it'll be interesting if any of those come up.
Yeah, it's a good movie. I like it. All right, I feel like we should get this movie. I'm picking for two reasons. First, it's definitely influential. I don't think anyone can argue that. It's still kind of, I don't know, movies like this sort of took over the 2000s to me. And because it genuinely freaked me the fuck out when I first saw it. I'm talking about, I think, one of the scariest movies I've seen. And I'm not afraid to admit it. I'm not ashamed that I was freaked out by The Ring.
Yep. Yep.
So before this movie, I really had no idea. I wasn't really familiar with J-horror because this came out when we were still in high school, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I saw it and it kind of blew my mind a little bit. I was just like completely terrified by it. To be honest, I'm not a huge fan of J-horror. I'm not a fan of a lot of the movies this movie spawned. I hated, The Grudge. I think The Grudge is, yeah, but whatever. I think this movie does all of the things those other movies couldn't do for me.
Uh-huh.
I think it successfully adapts the story, in a way that was relatable to me. As a Western audience without a huge horror background at that point, and it was genuinely, you know, fun and exciting and thrilling and scary to see it. Like, I think I took a girl to see it, and it was, it was that teenage high school horror movie experience. Like, it just made me think of, when my parents saw Alien in theaters and were freaked out to get in their car on the way home because they thought the alien was going to pop out of the back of, I went home and looked in a mirror and was like, my own reflection. Good dear God. So I think that's why is because, it just, when I first saw it, it genuinely scared the shit out of me.
Yeah. Super atmospheric, it scared me a lot too at that age. Directed by Gore Verbinski, who made the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, which is bizarre. It's a remake of a Japanese film, but.
Which I've never seen, Ringu.
Neither have I. I've always meant to, but I kind of don't want to traumatize myself, but, but I could probably handle it now. I think that, J-horror happened and there was a lot of bad movies like Dark Water in the Eye and One Missed Call and all this garbage. But I think that specifically the atmospheres of this movie and sort of the mystery element to it, because there's a little bit of Naomi Watts trying to piece together this mystery as it goes, which is a little out of genre a little bit for this type of thing. Mm-hmm. I think those elements have kind of creeped their way into the modern Blumhouse thing a little bit as well. Those movies have a lot of Amityville and Poltergeist and Shining as well. But I think, there's a little bit of The Ring in those movies. And specifically with wet, black-haired ghosts.
completely agree, especially atmosphere. Not really into them, so no comment?
Fair enough.
I just didn't really never did anything for me, so.
That's fair.
But beyond that, I can appreciate ghosts more now, but at the time especially, just fairly agnostic at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And just the supernatural, I just rolled my eyes at, and that was... It also just, I don't know, with many, not all, but many foreign adaptations of things, when I don't understand some of the cultural context, I just don't give a shit. Because it just doesn't ring clear with me.
I agree with that.
This was one of those films.
See,
That being said, Korean horror films, I fucking understand those completely.
See, that's one of the reasons I liked the adaptation of The Ring in particular was because I didn't feel that sort of cultural distance. Whereas, again, I compare this movie a lot to The Grudge because I think it came out, right after where it was just I was completely alienated and didn't enjoy it and was just like, this is dumb. So in general, I don't like this type of movie. I don't know. Maybe that's just because The Ring was the first one I saw. But I don't know. It just,
there's a lot to be said about that too. And I mean, that's not a bad thing. Whenever it hit, when something hits you, mm-hmm. that's always going to affect you in that way.
For sure. Yeah. And I think it hit American audiences in particular. Cause I mean, you know, we're yeah. still seeing movies that sort of,
well, this echo. Brought back, I mean, you know, among other things, this brought back, supernatural horror in a big way. And also, and maybe this is seen as a bad thing to a lot of horror fans, but it also kind of like expanded what you can do in a PG-13 horror. As far as, you can make something really scary, but if, as long as you're not showing guts and blood, you can actually kind of keep it within rating.
It's also the first time there, I think you kind of alluded to it, but it's also the first shift away from like, the slasher being the only, like, one of the only things that came onto screen.
Mm-hmm.
And that, yeah. that, in that respect, I actually do really dig that. So.
All right. That's my next pick. And let's see. What do I want to go with? We've done a lot of the heavy hitters. So, now we're kind of going into more personal favorites. I think for, and I don't know if any of us are going to touch anywhere else around this, but, I think for my torture porn entry, because it was a big part of this era, and maybe
absolutely.
One of the most written about of this era,
and I think important too.
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, you know, reintroducing extreme horror in a pop way. My favorite one that kind of came out of this era was Wolf Creek, which is Australian film, and. You know, about some people who get stranded in the wilderness, some horny college kids get stranded in the wilderness and get help from the wrong guy. And it's not necessarily the minimalism of the plot that makes it super interesting, but I think it's the effectiveness of it. It has that distinctly Australian thing where the landscape, you know, almost sort of a Western landscape is kind of informing the internal terror of what's going on.
Well, it feels oppressive. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and he has these big shots of like this crater that they're hiking around and he's kind of playing into the idea that the outback itself is not where people should be.
Well, they also take you from the city and just seclude you all the way out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that those sequences, those torture sequences when they come are really difficult to watch. And unlike the other movies in this genre, some better than others, I think this one doesn't feel like it's taking glee in exploiting the grotesqueness of the torture. It's actually using it, it sounds weird to say, but I think more empathetically than, you know, other people who did this stuff, who were doing it almost more as like, as a...
More reveling in it.
Yeah, more reveling in it, more kind of making it seem more fun or like a payoff. Whereas this movie doesn't want to pay you off. It actually really wants to disturb you.
Absolutely.
And I like
I would say it's one of the strongest entries for sure.
Yeah.
It's sad to see that director hasn't landed on his feet quite. Hasn't really hit his stride in some other ways. But yeah, no, I completely agree that out of all, I like a fair amount of the harder stuff. This is definitely one of the more effective ones.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't reinvent the wheel. I mean, it's almost kind of like basic in a Texas Chainsaw kind of way, but
yeah.
It definitely makes you feel.
Yeah.
It makes you feel the terror as opposed to just kind of present it to you.
Yeah.
I completely agree with you.
Performance in the antagonist and, mm-hmm. and the characters are drawn pretty well. It feels much more real than a lot of the other movies from that period.
Well, it's documentary feel. It feels real. It feels worn. It's not. It doesn't feel like you're following characters, which I don't have a problem with that if it presents you in the world
mm-hmm.
and everything feels like it's in that part of the world. But this just feels real world, and it feels dirty and grim.
Yeah.
And, all the things you said.
For sure.
Yeah, the only word I can use to describe this movie is brutal. This movie is just fucking brutal, but it's effective. And unlike, I think, other movies, that we've mentioned in the past, like, I can see comparison to, specifically like Last House on the Left, where it leaves you feeling icky and devastated.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like this movie, as opposed to that, is a lot more careful with the way it devastates you and mm-hmm. a lot more intentional. Whereas, you know, Last House on the Left, is much more, you know, an amateur filmmaker figuring out what he's doing. This feels, very confident in its direction.
Yeah, definitely. But I do think that, you know, the antecedents of this style of horror definitely live in the early 70s with films like Last House and Hills Have Eyes and Straw Dogs and all of that savage 70s stuff.
I'm kind of going to do the same thing you did and kind of pick a more personal one. I'm going to pick, Neil Marshall's The Descent.
Ooh, yes.
Thank you.
This now film is well, I was going to pick It or Dog Soldiers. I love both the films. I lean towards this, because I've been thinking about this, The Descent, a lot and want to rewatch it lately. But, and I think it's a little bit more at a technical level. While I think I have more of a soft spot for Dog Soldiers, The Descent, I think, is technically a more superior film, like at a shooting level and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if we're talking in a similar vein as Wolf Creek, the atmosphere is so much a part of it
mm-hmm.
that the literal setting becomes just as much integral to the plot and to what's happening, and it is very it becomes part of the metaphor of the story. It's specifically is the most important part of probably the whole movie.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, it's also just, I mean, it's fun because you get an all female cast. You get some interpersonal relationships. So, and then you just get these badass monsters
yeah.
and these fucking blood pits and just it's also a brutal film, you know?
I need to rewatch this.
And it doesn't pull its punches. The reason I've been thinking about it is because we hiked these big lava tunnels.
Uh-huh.
Near Mount St. Helens, and I ended up doing this big, huge, long portion by myself, and I had to literally crawl out of this hole in the ground. It was pretty badass, but I was by myself, and so the whole time I'm thinking like, oh shit, there's descent monsters crawling up behind me. This is badass. Anyway, I was having fun in my own head, but the movie in general, like, it has an indie sensibility,
uh-huh.
but like, I don't really feel it. Like, I don't ever feel hindered by it in any ways. I'm not ever like, oh, this is kind of hokey here, or that's kind of silly there. I think that Neil Marshall is pretty great at putting together just a very solid, impactful genre film. He knows how to use budgets. He knows what he's doing. Also, I don't think he gets enough credit for like infusing his films with a little bit of like this one I think is much more interpersonal versus some of his other movies, but this one I think does the best job of having some kind of subtext to it. So
also,
I think it's badass and you can watch it at any level.
Also, so. I think, talking about Neil Marshall being sort of an underrated director, I think he is one of the best at directing violence, specifically.
Absolutely.
He's able to, he directed episodes of Game of Thrones and I was like, ooh, somebody's head's gonna explode. But, he's so good at, doing violence that is both brutal as fuck, but also watchable as hell. But it doesn't do that thing, he doesn't do that thing where, I don't know, maybe this is a bad thing now that I say it, but, he invites
you relish in the violence.
He invites you to Yeah, I not relish, but to witness it.
You, Funny Games was right.
Fuck you. No, he invites you to witness it, whereas I feel like a lot of people use violence. A lot of directors, I think violence is more effective when you don't see it. He's one of the few directors where I think the violence is more effective when you do see it. Does that...
Maybe
something like RoboCop or something like that, where it's part of the film. It's integral to telling the story.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Paul Verhoeven's
It's not just like an extra thing. It's actually part of what you're watching. It might be operatic, the violence.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
might be telling you something, but it's also like letting you know about, you know, this violence inside of humanity. Maybe
it's part of his, it's part of his cinematic language.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely part of his cinematic
language. In the same way that like people like Tarantino use violence, or people, like George A. Romero use violence. It's part of the world that he's creating. It never comes off as exploitative, even though he does relish in the violence but it's part of the world he's creating, as opposed to trying to get you off with it.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I mean, I like the movie a lot. You know, you guys said pretty much everything there is to say about it. I should watch it again too, now that I'm thinking about it. It's been a minute.
It's been a while.
It's been a minute. Keith, go ahead.
We have two more picks. That was your fourth, Richard?
That was my fourth.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll go with my kind of quirky, offbeat sort of shout out, to the movie Trick or Treat.
Okay. Yeah.
I saw this movie for the first time, like just a couple years ago. I remember specifically a fun, Halloween memory of, Bender, actually, our friend Bender, bought this movie, and he was like, do you guys want to watch it? And I was like, what the fuck is this movie? Like, it looks terrible from the cover and like the art direction. I was like, what is this even? And then I finally watched it and I was like, oh, this is delightful.
Yeah.
This is such a fun, Halloween movie. And again, in the vein of, sort of like Shaun of the Dead and Slither, very referential, but specifically to, you know, sort of the old Halloween horror movies, you know.
Well, like Creepshow or something like
that. Yeah. And I like that it's this anthology movie. All the stories are these fun little twisted fairy tales. The little kid with the bag over his head, Sam.
Sam Hain, yeah.
Yeah. I think he's one of the more like iconic sort of movie monster slasher characters to come out of this period, because this was something that sort of fell out of fashion after the 80s, is having, you know, sort of this like pumpkin head style monster.
Yeah.
But he's packaged in this adorable little form. So I think this movie is a little underrated. I think it's really clever and fun, and especially this time of the year is just it's definitely pops up on my watch list now.
No, for sure. I love this film, and it's kind of in my head. The way you were explaining, I was almost like, yeah, it's almost the it's Halloween Charlie Brown just for like horror nerds.
Yeah, it totally is.
Yeah, or like one of those Rankin Bass Halloween specials.
But it's just specifically for horror fans.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I love it. It's, there's lots of quirky humor to it. There's kind of some punchlines, but then they're like the gore is fun.
Mm-hmm.
The plotting is fun.
Cool cast. I like how they have a really good cast.
Mm-hmm.
It does have an awesome cast. And the way that they stitch everything together is really cool.
Yeah. I'm upset that I literally judged this movie by its cover. back in the day, because I could have just had so many more Halloweens with it.
For sure. I enjoy the movie quite a bit for all those reasons. And it's kind of funny. This is the first of all of these weeks we've done of an anthology horror film, which is such a big part of horror genre.
Yeah.
That's come up. But it's a good one. Okay, what do I want to go with? I'm going to go with... Yeah, I'm going to go with The Others. The Others, which is a great gothic horror, paranormal, haunting mystery. This came out, I think, maybe a year after The Sixth Sense, and I think was kind of dismissed a little bit as being a Sixth Sense knockoff or clone. But I think it's better, and I think that it has a twist ending that is a part of what's going on here, but I think that it's played more emotionally than The Sixth Sense, and I also think that when you watch it again, knowing the twist ending, it actually kind of changes the viewing experience in a cool way. And I actually get a lot out of it every time I see it. And I believe this is done by the same Spanish director. I talked about other Spanish directors who were kind of working at this time. Alexander Amenabar. Did he do The Orphanage? I think he might have been a producer on that or something, but, he did the original, Open Your Eyes, which was later remade terribly into Vanilla Sky. This is a really cool, chilly, period horror film. I love the art direction of the movie and just again, the way that the set design sort of informs the story, very gothic horror in that sense. You feel kind of trapped in this house with these characters, and it has kind of like a, you know, this is like Nicole Kidman doing her best, like, chilly white lady Nicole Kidman performance. And it has a little bit of like a Flowers in the Attic vibe in some instances. I really dig this one. I think of all of like those kind of like ghosty whodunits that came out around this time, this is my favorite of those.
It's deeply atmospheric. I agree with that. I don't agree with the repeat viewings for me personally. I saw it once and then the second time I watched it, I was like, okay, it just didn't do much for me, but it definitely has a lot of great atmosphere and the performances are good. And also it's a form of horror that I don't think, I think people kind of dismiss as, antiquated. I think it still can be very effective when used right. I think you can even like something like, Stoker.
Stoker does kind of have this vibe. That same sort of like, a domestic horror kind of thing.
Well, it's also just that, it is like gothic horror in a real sense. And I think people kind of dismiss it, but I think, gothic horror does, really sets up, atmosphere and a setting like no other kind of horror does. Mm-hmm. And I think people kind of dismiss that. And that's really silly because that's one of the best ways to draw, like to affect your audience. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you had me when you said it was better than The Sixth Sense, because I agree with that entirely. I think The Sixth Sense is, terribly overrated, and, I remember when this came out, I was like, yeah, that's like doing the same thing, but better, kind of. But I think I like it more because of all those things you mentioned, because of the atmosphere, because of this, like, it sort of feels like a, it has sort of this, literature quality to it. Like, it uh-huh. feels like an old ghost story, which is cool. I will say on the repeat viewing thing, I think on repeat viewing, the problem with repeats of this movie is, I feel like the horror isn't as nearly as effective when you sort of know what's going on. I think a lot of where the horror comes from is this idea of not understanding and totally.
I would argue that it's a different kind of horror on repeat viewing. The first time it's the mystery and element and what's behind the curtain and like kind of that stuff, the mystery box element that kind of is pulling the tension of the movie. Whereas the, on repeat viewings, knowing, what we know about the characters, then it becomes a lot more of a psychological horror about more of an existential kind of thing of what is your environment and how much do we really know about ourselves?
I can buy that.
This is your,
I'm going to go for the Hail Mary. This is my masterpiece. The one I'm going to leave everybody with. And I'm going to choose Jason X.
What?
Are you serious here? I'm fucking serious. Yes, I love Jason X. Are you kidding me? This film is so fun to watch.
All right.
I mean, first of all, okay. A lot of horror nerds and dorks, geeks, whatever you want to refer to yourself as, they love Jason Voorhees. I love Jason Voorhees. He's just a murdering, killing, zombie demon thing. That's all. He doesn't need character. He has a fucking machete. This is a genius film in the fact that they're like, you know, that's not enough. We need to put him in space.
Fuck you.
So, no, I'm being serious. I love watching this film. Like, yeah, it's a silly film. I'm not going to deny that I don't watch it somewhat ironically. But I love watching it. The gore effects, some of the humor in it. There's one scene, there's this hologram scene. And it's just one of the best, as a horror nerd, that's just something for this character that I always, you know, just a fun setup.
Uh-huh.
So, I can see how people can find it campy, can find it stupid in that sense, but that's why I enjoy it. Like, it is a fun time to watch. Like, it is vastly more entertaining than many horror films are, and in a sense, when I watch it, I enjoy it more than some of the films that even some of the ones we've talked about that I deeply like.
Mm-hmm.
I can sit down, and that's what's great about horror, is you do can get that popcorn kind of silly factor out of it. And I think Jason X is an excellent way to do that.
I get what you're saying for, I mean, I'll defend that. Maybe to, on some kind of trollish level, if I was thinking about like films in general of the early 2000s, I would maybe include The Room, because I think The Room is vastly rewatchable. Like you can plug that in and just have fun with it whenever. You can turn your brain off and just enjoy it. And it is always fascinating to look at. And in that sense, I think you can kind of get that with Jason X. There's a lot of like kind of camp horror that comes from this time, like, we've done so many sequels that we're now, like, into the level of absurdity. Like, something like Bride of Chucky kind of comes out around this time. Freddy vs. Jason, which would have been my pick for something like this. For memory wise,
between three of us, yes, when we went and we cheered like it was sports teams, Freddy vs. Jason, that was a great experience, and I love that film too. Even on rewatch, it's Looney Tunes. It's fun. Yeah. But this film, you know, I made a lot of people watch.
Mm.
I remember even on a drama competition, I made a bunch of people watch it in a room. And every time I get a kick out of it, I think it is campy and fun. And at a popcorn level, it's just exciting.
All right. You've convinced me. I think
I'm not being
agree.
Trollish. I legitimately enjoy it.
I think I would agree with Cassidy in that. Personally, I would pick Freddy vs. Jason because I think it has the camp factor from sort of both sides. And it sort of culminates in that idea of, you know, how many sequels can we squeeze out of these characters? But as far as Jason standalones, I would agree that Jason X is probably the most ridiculous. And it feels like, it's shot like a porno. I get what you're saying. It's like, it is peak ridiculousness to the point where they're not, like, the studios aren't even going to give this character even any budget to work with.
We've talked about it.
Kind of magic.
Actually, what's funny about this is they gave an okay budget to this. And what's funny is if you go and watch like the special features specifically, you think I'm not a fan of this. Like I literally watched the special features for this film. Like the CG at the time was some of the better CG at the time. It's not good compared to today's standards, and it's easy to look back and make fun of, but at the same time, it is sort of weird and indicative of this time period to be like, yeah, we could put this character in space because we have the technology to do so. And I look at it as a bit of a comedy, but there's no way that the people who made this did it completely seriously.
Yeah.
There's too many of the jokes, there's too much of the, and they have fun with it, but they don't also take, I also think that they don't take, they don't take it too, while they don't take themselves too seriously, they also don't just make a complete mockery of the character. They say, this is what's fun about watching these. You can take it completely out of its setting, and it's still entertaining.
All right.
Okay, Keith, what's your last pick?
I'm gonna go back to one of my favorite movie monsters, and that's vampires. I'm gonna throw on 30 Days of Night. It made vampires fucking brutal and scary again. In a time when, just after the 90s, when they were very romanticized, this movie was really refreshing to see them be fucking serial killers and nightmare monsters. This movie, I think, has a bit of a problematic sort of superhero ending. Has sort of dragged it down a little bit in my mind. But honestly, I think a lot of horror movies have, their third acts are usually the worst part. I don't know. It's a fun movie, cool concept, does something new with, a staple of Hollywood monsters. So.
Yeah, I like this movie quite a bit. And I think, yes, there's a vampire aspect of it, based on the comic book, by Steve Niall. And I think it like does a good job of sort of visualizing sort of, Templeton, is that his name?
Ben Temple Smith.
Ben Temple Smith. It does a good job of sort of recapturing that kind of smeary artwork in the movie. It has sort of a cool digital look to the film. But it is also, I think, kind of riffing on both the survival zombie aspect of it. Like, we gotta fortify these walls, and we're gonna send this person out to get the truck, and da-da-da. There's a lot of stuff we see, like, in Night of the Living Dead. But then there's also kind of this, like, isolative, snowy terror of the thing. I think it's kind of referential in a cool way. I do have issues with the ending as well. And Josh Hartnett is never like an actor I get excited about, but I think that, it's a cool, like, visceral horror film.
There's so many, I think, movies where the sort of threat of vampires is taken away, especially with the twilightification of them. This movie, I think, is cool because it does sort of
made him ghoulish again.
Yeah, it establishes them in a new context. Like you said, that it plays more like a zombie survival film than your typical vampire film.
Yeah.
And so I think there's some cool stuff with that. And there's some gorgeous visuals. That fucking tracking shot with the towns going to hell.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, this is the director, David Slade, who later went on to make a Twilight film. He's like some of these other guys we've talked about. I'd really like to see him kind of get his footing back and do something cool. Cause, he did Hard Candy, with Ellen Page. And then he did this movie, like two really strong starts. And then he's just kind of teetered off since.
Well, I'd argue that he's actually like Neil Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
He's gone into TV. And in Hannibal, some of the scenes in that are the most gorgeous I've seen on TV, period.
Okay.
So I don't think that's fair to say because while TV isn't the same as film, it's still
it's true.
A viable a viable medium.
Yeah.
And he's done really good work in Hannibal. And even though the director isn't the prestige character in TV, he did really great episodes also in American Gods. And that's another beautifully shot. Basically, the showrunners on those, his name escapes me right now, but I love his stuff.
All right. This is my last pick and the last pick of the draft. And I'm kind of where you are, Keith, where I got all my big heavy hitters out of the way. So I'm kind of just looking at what I have left, but I think the one that I'm going to go with, you know, this isn't even a movie I particularly have a strong attachment to. And this isn't a movie that, plays a big part in my life. I saw it like kind of way later after its initial release, and it, kind of brought upon us a franchise that I cared nothing about really, but I think that it launched a really cool director, and it is unmistakably super important when we're talking about early 2000s horror, and that is the first Saw.
Okay. I almost picked that for my last one. Yeah.
No, I think it gets a lot of shit because of the next like 10 or 12 or whatever, how many there are.
Yeah.
But it got diluted quickly.
Yeah.
And, but I think the first film is, it kind of solidifies that ultra violence, if you will, of this time period.
It does. And it's a lot more sophisticated than I think people remember it being because of those sequels. The sequels sort of play upon the fantasy aspect of like the torture and the room, like the crazy like escape rooms, and all of those like, you know, the crazy creative kills.
And I think they've now kind of made Jigsaw like a sympathetic character, which I'm like, what the fuck are they doing?
They kind of like leaned into that in later iterations. But I think that James Wan here, this is much more of kind of a smaller film than the other ones. It's much more kind of like minimal locations. It's more of a psychological thing because it's about these people like, they don't know where they are, what they're doing there. They have to make these choices. And so it's kind of playing more into the psychology of what they're doing rather than like the eventual like crazy contraption stuff they have to do. And I mean, that's all fun or whatever. And it has a cool look to it. I think James Wan is really, really good about using his budgets, and he's really good at building tension. And he's pretty decent, actors director. I mean, this has Cary Elwes and this has Danny Glover and like real people we've heard of. It's, you know, when it first came out, I kind of dismissed it as being like, you know, the ideology of Seven meets kind of the trap aspect of the movie Cube. I think the fact that this weird little widget of a movie ended up spawning this huge franchise that people still talk about, you know, says something of the effectiveness of at least the first one.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. I don't have a problem with this movie. I actually liked this movie, quite a bit when I first saw it.
We saw it at the Alameda Triplex.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
You saw it when it was new. I saw it like maybe 4 years later.
I think all of what you're saying is true. I think my problem with this is sort of the legacy it's had, and maybe it's just more fresh for me because I've sort of, you know, grown up and lived during the shitty Saw sequels where I didn't have to do that during like the shitty Nightmare on Elm Street sequels and the shitty Friday the 13th sequels. Those were all just existed, when I was a kid. So maybe that's why it's just, I'm a little more jaded against that franchise.
It's often credited in a derogatory sense for creating torture porn, and it's just all throwaway and garbage. And I mean, there is definitely a bias towards this film, and I think that people don't really sometimes realize how strongly that plays into how we view and feel and see things.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what I was getting at is, you know, like the Eli Roth movies, like Hostel, I fucking hate it. But if you strip that sort of, legacy context away and just go back to this movie, you know, it's an effective thriller. It's, like you said, it does a lot with a little, and, you know, at the end of the day, the movie itself, if you just sat down and watched the movie, it's a pretty cool, good,
yeah,
little horror.
If you try and strip away all of the other noise that surrounds this franchise, if you just look at this movie as the only one that would have come out, and just kind of look at it objectively, it's a cool little indie violent thriller.
Yeah, it sort of takes that thriller element of the 90s that, you know, we were talking about in the last episode, and makes it,
and then art directs horror it within an inch of its life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, no, I think it's, you know, it's totally valid.
Yeah, and it's funny that I put end up on my list, because, like I said, this is not a movie that I own, I even really think about watching again, but I can acknowledge that it was important and indicative of the era.
I almost mentioned the movie, like, with every one of my numbers, so.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and talk quickly about our what didn't make it on the list, and I'll just mention the few that I have left because I really don't have that many. We talked about most of them. Another cool anthology film, The Signal, I really liked from this time period. The only reason I didn't talk about it is because I've only seen it the once, and I would like to see it again before I have official opinions about it.
It's definitely on my list.
Yeah. The Mothman Prophecies. Which is a really cool, atmospheric, kind of supernatural thing. Genre-wise, it's a little hard to pin down, but I think that there is enough horror elements you could call it a horror film. Yeah, I enjoy that movie a great deal. Freddy vs. Jason, which we talked about. House of the Devil, which now I'm mad I didn't pick that. Fuck. But that's a good movie.
Also on my list.
Definitely.
I've never seen that one.
Yeah, really good. The Strangers, which is a cool home invader, you know, ride of a movie. Yeah, I mean it's super effective. Yeah. But it, for me, it was between that and Funny Games, and I went with Funny Games mostly to trigger Keith.
Yeah, you fucking troll, troll ass troll.
Collectively, I included Grindhouse as a thing. You know, both Planet Terror and Death Proof. I don't know exactly how to, like, reckon with that movie as far as, like, where to put it and how to think about it in terms of genre filmmaking. It's almost so, movie about movie that it kind of exists outside of all genre.
Yeah,
well,
but
it's fairly nostalgic too. I mean.
Yeah.
I have this one was on my honorable mentions too, because it sort of introduced me not to the idea of Grindhouse, like I sort of always knew what Grindhouse was, but it put a name to it for me. And
for sure.
So I think it's, you know, it's worth mentioning for doing that for, you know, in the 2000s, when nobody was interested in really doing that. So.
Yeah. And I think that's it. That's mostly what I had on my list. Richard, what's some stuff you want to say now?
Maybe I should go first so he can just list off his 40 fucking movies.
Yeah, go.
Okay, real quick. I like that. You mentioned Dog Soldiers. I just want to shout out to Neil Marshall, for making my list a couple times. Other than that, shout out to, I think, the only, the most palatable Zack Snyder movie, Dawn of the Dead, sort of a lesser 28 Days Later. But I think right along in the conversation with, reviving the zombie genre, Cloverfield for, introducing, you know, the found footage thing in a big way. I think in my opinion, the best Texas Chainsaw remake, total high school nostalgia movie, House of a Thousand Corpses.
That is actually probably would be, should be number five, but I have a soft spot for Jason X, so I'm not going to change it, but that is up there. And I think that Rob Zombie, I still like a lot of his films, and I think he gets a lot of, I think the internet has combined against him and more people dislike him than really understand him or really understand his work.
Mm-hmm.
I understand some people being viscerally not drawn to it. It's rough. He doesn't make any mentions. He doesn't even try. But this one, specifically House of a Thousand Corpses, it is like a love letter to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but it's got a really fun vibe. It does some cartoony things, but in a fun way, and I think it's hard to mix some of those things.
And I also still has think fun characters. I still think it's Zombie's best movie that I've seen, so.
Agreed.
All right, just rattle them off.
Okay. These are just some of my honorable mentions, the ones that I'm just gonna list some of them, and some of them I'll make a little comment. Okay, Ginger Snaps, Pitch Black, cool sci-fi horror. Ichi the Killer, also, 1999, if you guys didn't put Audition on your list before.
We did.
In your 90s thing, then you're stupid.
I got you.
Okay, thank you. Mulholland Drive, I would kind of count in the horror realm.
Yeah.
13 Ghosts is a really dumb movie, but I have a soft spot for it and like it. Blade 2, badass. Bubba Hotep's fun. Maze fun. Resident Evil, Freddy vs. Jason. High Tension. I really like Jeeper Creepers too, not gonna lie. We listed all the Hills Have Eyes remake. I think this is an underrated one actually, and I think it has, I think it's a lot better than people give it credit.
Mm-hmm.
Them was a French horror. Check it out if you haven't seen it. You can pick it up on streaming randomly. You already said The Signal, Cloverfield. Oh, one of the big ones, Let the Right One In. This is a fun Swedish like horror vampire one. Antichrist, while I hate it, I understand its validity and it bruised me and made me feel dirty. Drag Me to Hell, fun. It's, you know, I think it holds up to the kind of like the Evil Dead legacy, honestly. I really like Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. It's kind of a crazy film, but I dig it. Pan's Labyrinth, obviously, we already talked about that. Le Horde. The Horde.
Yeah.
Another French, zombie one. Really fun. We talked about House of the Devil. Splice was a fun one.
That was on my short list too, yeah.
Yeah, it was a weird sexual thing going on. And then, this film, I know you guys disagree, but Rubber. I really liked that one. And then
Rubber's pretty fun.
And then from 2010, also Tucker and Dale vs. Evil. It's a fun film. I can watch it all the time. Yeah. So I'm sure I actually forgot a few, but those are some of the ones that I really dig. And yeah.
I'm pretty sure you just mentioned like every horror movie
that was released
in the early 2000s.
No, there's some that you mentioned and I was like, oh damn, how'd I forget that? But you know, such is life.
It is such as life, but at the same time, no, these are all films I enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
I would consider owning. Yeah. Some of them are for camp factor. Some of them are because I think they're like very technically well-made movies.
Mm-hmm.
And some it's because they hit me like 13 Ghosts isn't a good movie. Like the ending is absolutely terrible, but like the aesthetics of the ghosts and the little rooms, I don't know. I just thought it was really cool. Like the concept, but.
All right. Well, let's do it. Let's do, let's go ahead and talk about Halloween 2018. And I guess I'll set this up. Okay, so this is partially written by Danny McBride, really? Am I reading that correctly?
Yes, you were reading correctly.
And David Gordon Green, who directed Danny McBride in films such as Your Highness and Pineapple Express. Before David Gordon Green was doing Apatow adjacent stoner comedies, he did art flicks like George Washington and Snow Angels. So he's had a really weird career. And now he's doing this Blumhouse produced remake, reboot, reimagining of Halloween. I guess the way that's,
NyQuil. It's a NyQuil.
The way that they kind of relaunched this is to ignore Halloween's 2 through whatever it went up to. And this is a direct sequel to just the first Halloween from 1978. It takes place, in real time, so 40 years later, and, Jamie Lee Curtis, / Laurie, is now an older lady. She's dealing with trauma over a long period of time. She's become sort of a survivalist, a doomsday prepper, and she's taught, her daughter, Judy Greer, how to hunt from an early age and how to take care of herself and how to shoot guns and all this stuff. They have since had a rift in the family because, that's a terrible way to raise somebody. And, right, on the 40th anniversary, where Michael Myers is supposed to be, getting, executed, he escapes and, it becomes a hunt, but it also becomes, the Huntress, hunting the hunter. What did we think of Halloween 2018?
I mean, to me, this is, I think the best way to sum it up is this is The Force Awakens, but for Halloween movies.
Like, a little bit.
It's, you know, it's retreading basically, you know, all the plot points. But it, you know, to a modern aesthetic, to a new audience. And a couple issues.
And it does it fairly effective in many, many areas.
Yeah, I, for one, am kind of relieved by the whole, let's throw out the last, you know, 40 years of continuity, because it got so weird and muddy and, you know, Busta Rhymes and LL Cool J. Like, I'm glad we don't have
to. Hey, LL Cool J survived. That's important.
I'm glad we don't have to deal with any of that baggage because I haven't seen a lot of, you know, the other Halloween movies. So it was nice to just be like, all I need to know is the first one.
As somebody who's seen all of them and fairly recently, it's still fine because you still have those movies. You can go back
sure,
to them.
Yeah.
Yeah,
this is just another iteration. To me, you know, people like Michael Myers are a campfire story, and they should have different tellings and different ways of looking at it.
Yeah.
And I think that this is just a viewpoint to look at this character.
Yeah, yeah. I think so, sure, for sure. And I mean, you know, originally the Halloween franchise was supposed to be,
an anthology sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where every film is like a different story altogether, just with the theme of Halloween.
Like Halloween 3.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen
it. Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which does not have Michael Myers and was an immediate flop. And that's why we had 12 Michael Myers movies afterwards. And has only now since kind of been reevaluated critically.
Yeah, so
well, what's interesting is you could compare this to like H2O in a lot of ways.
Sure.
And I have seen some people do that. Yeah, cause that was another one that brought back Jamie Lee Curtis and...
Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, it hits some similar notes, but not quite. It's definitely a time period thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then it also like, but you also, I think you have to factor in the fact that, again, Rob Zombies, they were popular to a lot of people. They're not very popular on the internet right now, but they are, but many people like them and they have, they also did an interpretation of the character.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's almost, it's the way we're kind of seeing it is we're almost, it's almost Michael Myers' character in this story is almost kind of becoming, it's almost like a Star is Born. Like every generation, you can kind of retell the story in a new way with a new aesthetic.
And I think that's fine.
Yeah, it's so elemental. You know, you could say that the Rob Zombie versions was kind of the era of the torture porn version of the character, or and H2O is kind of the post Scream version, and this is kind of more in the Blumhouse camp. But
well, I mean, it was a Blumhouse movie, right?
It was co-produced. And I think David Gordon Green is a competent filmmaker. I think on a visual level, the movie works actually pretty well. There's a lot of, good, cool tracking shots. Obviously, they're kind of referring a little bit to Carpenter's style. Cause Carpenter doesn't like to use a lot of cuts either unless he has to, or if he does, they're very precise and for a reason. He's a very economic filmmaker in that way. And I think David Gordon Green is kind of picking up that visual language a little bit, and playing around with it as he does, you know, direct narrative references in the film as well. This is a movie I don't really feel strongly about one way or the other. It's fine. I think as far as Halloween sequels go, I've seen much worse. I don't think that it's doing anything particularly exciting with it. What we have here is we have about 75% of the movie, which is just Michael Myers going around killing people, which is fine. We've gotten 40 years of that before. And then the last 25% of the movie is this kind of, battle of wits, between, Laurie and Michael, and it kind of becomes like a cat and mouse thing. And I kind of wish that the movie had played that angle more and for longer. And I wish that it had been, you know, a little bit more rock and roll and had a little bit more fun with these two characters, you know, battling it out, because we have her in this, like, you know, crazy, frizzy-haired, wild lady in the woods vibe, and I'm into that, and I just wish that we had gotten, like, a little bit more of that throughout, just so that this movie distinguishes itself a little bit more than I think it does. But overall... Yeah,
a little bit more character work. I can agree with that.
Yeah, I agree with that, because... So that actually brings me to my big criticisms about the movie. Like, overall, I thought it was a fun... Some really cool visuals going on.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, but I think that there was some frustrating stuff as far as like what the actual purpose of the movie was. On paper, you know, I can see that they pitched it as, you know, Laurie Strode is this hardcore survivalist, you know, get paranoid stuff, but there's a lot of, tell and not show as far as that goes. And I agree. I wanted some more show. Like, you know, there's a scene where they have like 15 guns in a bunker and then they don't use any of them. I'm like, okay. So there's some, you know, some stuff where it's like, she's supposed to be the smart, you know, confident,
super prepared person.
Yeah, but then she also makes some dumb horror movie mistakes. So
yeah.
there's a little bit of a frustration for me on that level. And also, like, I think thematically you could have done a little more with it too. Like, they sort of flirt with the idea that, you know, well, did Michael make her a monster too? But they don't really do anything interesting with that. They don't really go there. And I kind of wish they had. And I think Judy Greer's a little miscast. Those were my big complaints.
That I disagree with, but other than that, I agree with pretty much everything you guys have said. Because, as a horror fan and just like eating popcorn and in the theater, this was a fun time.
Yeah.
There was nothing that offended me. There was this was a competent, well-made movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that I enjoyed. But if I look at it at a more critical, kind of analytic level, there is something that's sort of flat about it, and I think that both you and Cassidy hit different points. I don't think that we were exposed to enough of Jamie Lee Curtis's character, like who she was as a mother, how she fits into the equation. I don't think we were, Judy Greer. I actually like Judy Greer, and that whole, like, kind of, there's this kind of moment. She gets this really cool character moment later in the thing, and I think it pays off really well. And I was like, oh, that's fucking cool. There's this really weird moment in the middle. I'm glad that it went away fast.
I think I know what you're talking about. And
it felt very genre typical and not in a good way. It felt very stupid, but it goes away really quickly. So that was kind of fun.
Right. Without giving anything away, are we talking about stuff about Dr. Sartain?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
that's a
Dr.
character
Sartain,
I almost feel like could have been out of the movie completely.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed. And beyond that too, I mean, there is sort of allusions to that in the many of the other Halloween films, but that one, just how it happened and played out, just felt very cartoony.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
But some of the setups in this are...
I don't know. I agree. Like, I agree with what you're saying, but I don't know. Because it does feel so sort of convoluted and messy and on genre, I was like, yeah, that makes sense in a Halloween sequel.
You're not wrong in that sense, but at an analytical level, I can't say, like, yeah, that was a good choice. That couldn't have just been edited out.
It felt like a weird studio note that just somehow, like, it's a scene that should have hit the cutting room floor. But go ahead.
And I would have much rather them use that screen time to, you know, to develop Jamie Lee Curtis's character a bit more.
Well, and I think Judy Greer's. I don't think Judy Greer was miscast. I think she was fun. I think she didn't get enough time to really show us much about that character.
Yeah,
but
and that might be more what it is. Yeah, she just felt out of place to me.
This has some of the best setups in a horror film I've seen, period.
Yeah, that's true.
Like I will say at that level, we were talking about some of the scenes and some of the setups were incredible. And they did a lot of different varying. Uh-huh. They showed you the gore. They showed you the violence. But then they also kept it off camera. Or sometimes they showed you what happened before and then after.
Uh-huh.
Some of these setups are kind of brilliant. The problem is that it doesn't pay off. I felt like the high schoolers were a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I wish that was brought into the plot more.
They felt real
and modernized. Mm-hmm. And the humor elements of the teenagers,
uh-huh,
didn't overtake any of the film and be like, oh, this is a comedy.
No.
It just felt naturalistic.
No, some of that stuff, you know, they go to a dance and whatever. Some of that stuff even kind of reminded me a little bit of like the feeling of Carrie. Like they were kind of going for that.
Oh, you mean the original?
Okay. The original, yeah. But I mean, with just the way that the teenagers interact and like there's this thing that's going to happen, blah, blah, blah. But, yeah. I kind of feel like that is almost a different movie than the rest of the movie. And I feel like...
You're not wrong.
To me that goes back to this being the Force Awakens to...
Right, yeah, but that's what I'm saying. There's that movie, the referential, like, let's update Halloween, and we're gonna call it Halloween without a Roman numeral or a number after it. And like, it's gonna be this official sort of retelling, reimagining, also sequel, mid-soft reboot, maybe. But, and then there's the, like, what I think is a more interesting movie, which is the Laurie versus Michael thing.
Yes.
And I think those two movies are sort of battling.
Yeah, I get that a little.
I think that they could be tied together, and I think we've already kind of talked about what that key factor was that didn't...
Yeah.
That didn't let those two things, I think there just needed to be more screen time, but at the same time that would bog it down.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to say. I don't think that they needed to pick one, but I think that there's definitely a thing we could have cut out. That being said, like again, as a fan of the franchise and the series and stuff like that, and just a horror fan in general,
yeah,
this was a fun time. This was a fun time and I didn't feel like I wasted my money. No. I didn't feel like, and I kind of think it does have some cinematic merits.
Yeah, I actually honestly, think that if David Gordon Green, if David Gordon Green wanted to go out and make more horror films, I think he has an act for it. I think he's good at at doing this type of thing.
The timing in some of those was fucking spectacular.
Yeah,
like scene wise, I these are some of the best setups I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
I think anyway. I agree with that. I think. Yeah, there were elements that held this movie back from sort of reaching a higher level, but what this movie is aiming to do, I think it does really well. This was exactly what I wanted. It wasn't anything more, which would have been nice, but it did.
But I think that's what's disappointing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it was so close.
Yeah.
It was like right on the tipping point of being like, holy shit, this is great. But it settles on being a really good sequel.
Yeah, that's where I'd put it. I would say it's about on par with Halloween 2. If we're going to talk about like, which is one of the better Halloween sequels for sure. I just don't think it transcends genre really at all, or really transcends the best moments of this franchise. But it sits nicely in it. It's certainly not a blemish on the franchise.
Yeah.
I think I'm hungry.
I think maybe you are. All right. If I was to give this grade, it's like a B-. It's fine.
I give it a B+.
I'll give it a B to be contrary.
Right in the middle.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, that is the episode. And if anybody has any opinions about any of the things we said, we did say a lot. go ahead and email us at jabberandthrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook and facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can find us on Twitter at jabberpodcast as well as on Instagram at jabberpodcast. You can stream us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, the player.fm, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play. You can follow me individually on Twitter at VC Cassidy. Is there anything you want to promote before I pass it off to Keith?
There's a couple things. First off, I want to mention my, first short story that was published last year in Muzzlelands Press is, 16 Bits of Terror that can be purchased on Amazon. Or if you're a good person, you'll go to muzzlelandpress.com, go to their store, and purchase it through Envy. That way that the actual small press gets more of their money instead of like a large chunk being taken by Amazon. And that's a fun piece. It's the story I did for it's called A Lump in His Boy. But then the other thing I'd like is the second story that I'm going to be, that I just got published. It's up on ebook right now, is in a anthology called, Bikers Versus the Undead. Sort of like, you know, a biker, leather clad badass versus zombies, vampires, whatever, what you have it. But that's actually through Dead Man's Tome. Dead Man's Tome is a small Texas press that, do anthologies every once in a while when they can, but, they usually publish things like every week or so. So you can kind of go and get some free stories there if you want. So that's really cool. People will have a chance to, win a free signed copy if they follow Mr. Deadman DT on Twitter. This offer ends on November 1st. So, if you're interested in horror and maybe scoring a free, anthology, go ahead and go over to Mr. Deadman DT on Twitter. Check that kind of stuff out. But again, it's a fun little site. They've got some free stuff and they've also got a bunch of anthologies from people. So, you can check out my story. It's about a bunch of BMX kids that, find their methy biker dad in a graveyard and, deal into some unholy beings. So.
Sounds fun. Keith, what about you?
Cool. Well, I haven't published any stories. That's exciting. Congrats, Richard.
Thank you.
I just have a couple shows coming up, this Saturday, the 27th. Is your last chance to see Book Club Presents Vampire Romance. It's the improv show I'm part of at Old Town Improv Company. We take a different book genre every month and improvise an entire story for you. For Halloween, we are doing Vampire Romance. Last one was really fun. It had werebears. It had vampires, it had romance. So make sure you check that out. It's one of my favorite shows we've done so far. Also at Old Town Improv Company on November 9th, that's Friday, November 9th, I'm planning on doing a, sort of an alternative comedy show there. It's not going to be a traditional improv show. It's going to be more, stand-up, sketch, characters, just kind of stuff that you can't really find anywhere else in San Diego is what I'm hoping the show becomes. So please come to that. That's going to be Friday, November 9th. It's, $10, but message me if you want comps. I'll have plenty of comps to give away. And it's going to be, I think around 9:30 PM. I'll have more information probably on the next episode. But yeah, come check that out because I'm hoping this kind of becomes a regular show that I can do at Old Town Improv Company. I'll have all this information at my website, www.keithfosterkid.com. And you can follow me on Instagram and I guess Twitter, but burn the establishment down.
Okay. Be sure to check out our friends out there in the podcast universe. That includes Patrick and Dennis over at Almost Educational, and Rod and Moksha over at The Listening Party, Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places, Bill and Brian over at The Great Albums Podcast, and Mike Valick over at Hack Thought. Keith, you had some too.
Yeah, check out Adam Connie and the Adamant Podcast. Also check out Campfire Shit Show with Marilyn Bowe.
All right. And Richard, thank you for coming on.
Hey, no problem. Also, I'm going to try to update my site so that those, that you can find those, both of those ones. And that's at, www.rdwally, spelled W-O-L-L-E-Y.weebly.com. So I'll try to do that. I'm really shitty at doing that. You can follow me on Pinterest because that's the kind of guy I am. I'm a Pinterest guy. And that's it. That's all I do.
All right. And that's
on
the show.
That note, there were bikers and gnarly psychos and crazy evil.